What's up, queens? Welcome to the Female Dating Strategy Podcast, the meanest female-only podcast on the internet. I'm Ro.
And I'm Savannah. And we are back with Attached Part 2. We are getting attached, or maybe not attached, again. So we released Part 1, where we covered what attachment styles is, or what the theory behind it is. And just to do a brief recap, attachment theory is essentially a theory around specific patterns of behaviors in and around relationships. And the psychologists who came up with the theory, and I want to emphasize that it is a theory, it's not absolute, just like a lot of things in psychology are just theories and ideas, because it's really difficult to essentially study and test human behavior in an objective way. But the psychologists who conceptualized attachment theory basically said that when children are very, very young, they form their adult attachment style based on the attachment that they have with their primary caregiver. And Ro and I noted in Part 1 that when they say primary caregiver, bearing in mind attachment theory was formulated around the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, they were really talking about the mum as well, which is kind of misogynistic if we think about it. Anyway, they identified four adult attachment styles, which were avoidant attachment style, disorganized attachment style, an anxious attachment style, and a secure attachment style as well. And so in Part 1, Ro and I overviewed the avoidant attachment style and the anxious attachment style. And we came at it from a lens where we basically feel like, well, the royal we, I speak for myself here.
We decided. I can't even do the British accent anymore.
Is it because you've just been listening to me all the time?
It is. I promise you, it's like I've become ear blind to the British accent. It's true.
I don't think I could do an American one either anymore. So I think for me, attachment theory, because I just like gathering information, I think it's useful from a personal standpoint to be aware of it, but I would be wary of applying it to other people or trying to apply it to your relationships with men, because I feel, especially if you identify that somebody is exhibiting behaviors that are avoidant, for example, that can and has kept women in objectively bad relationships, because they are essentially putting the onus of the relationship or the reason as to why their needs are not being met down to the attachment style, as opposed to the actual person that they're with.
Yeah, because ultimately, if you're not getting your needs met,
it doesn't matter.
Once again, it doesn't matter. I mean, it takes a lot of self-work, self-examination to, even if you have legitimately some of these more dysfunctional attachment styles, it takes a lot of self-work. And it's really, really hard to put that on someone else to fix, right? Because ultimately, it's an internal battle.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we're going to talk about the secure attachment style in more detail in this episode, but it's also important as well. I mean, even though the secure attachment style is positioned as almost like the gold standard of attachment styles, that doesn't necessarily mean that being in a relationship with somebody who exhibits, say, for example, secure behaviors is also going to be pleasant as well. Because like very rightfully said, you don't get into relationships with attachment styles, you get into relationships with people. I do feel like in the attachment theory literature, it's almost like people who have a secure or who are perceived to have a secure attachment style, they are put on this like pedestal as being the gold standard partner, when actually that doesn't mean to say that they are the perfect people to be in a relationship with, or that they also won't meet your relationship needs in a particular way, if that makes sense. So we have to be careful with that as well.
Yeah, because I mean, ultimately it's character, right? You can have any of these attachment styles and have a poor character or a good character.
Exactly. So we're going to cover the final two in the four today, and we're also going to share our final thoughts on attachment theory and also where it sits within the FDS repository, so to speak. So the third, I guess, dysfunctional attachment style is the disorganized attachment style. And actually, I think the term is quite fitting for disorganized attachment style, because the symptoms, so to speak, are basically a hybrid of the anxious and avoidant attachment styles. And this one is, and that's essentially what makes it difficult for psychologists or clinical psychologists to actually identify this particular attachment style and actually treat it as well, which also makes you question if it can really objectively exist, if it can't be objectively diagnosed, so to speak. So the traits of a disorganized attachment style, or a DA, as they are often abbreviated to, is that they, almost like the avoidant attachment style, they crave close relationships, but they also fear them at the same time. And slightly pivoting away from the avoidant attachment theory, like model, the theory is that people with a disorganized attachment style are believed to have that attachment style because of childhood trauma or abuse. Or like a child who develops avoidant tendencies as an adult, it may not necessarily be down to trauma or abuse. It could just be unintended neglect or inconsistency from the primary caregiver, or even just, you know, not necessarily being attuned to the child's needs all the time. Whereas a disorganized attachment style is generally believed as a result of child trauma, and as a result of the child being subjected to prolonged and repeated trauma during childhood, they essentially become extremely fearful about forming relationships and attachments with other people. So just like any other child or infant, they rely on their caregivers. But when a child recognizes that their primary caregiver is a source of, you know, fear for them, this creates a massive problem with their internal working model, because children, or infants especially, they should be able to feel like their parent is a safe and secure base, a person that they can go to without feeling any fear. And this is, again, where I have issues with attachment theory, is that it places a lot of emphasis on the primary caregiver slash the woman, because even in today's world, it's still women doing majority of the childcare. So not much has moved on in that arena. But it's also very possible for a child to have, you know, multiple primary caregivers, such as a worker at daycare, or their grandparents, or their aunts and uncles, or their cousins, or other people looking after the child. So this fixation on it just, you know, being a singular primary caregiver, i.e. the mother, is a pretty outdated model as well. And it's a key criticism of the attachment theory, like, model in general, in that attachment theory is really based on the Western model of raising children. In the Western model of raising children, generally speaking, people tend to be raised within the nuclear family. So you have a mum and a dad and then siblings. And that tends to be the extent of the support system in raising a child. If you go to places like Africa or India, it's very, very common for children to not only be raised by their mother and father, but also by extended family members as well. You know, so for example, aunts and uncles and like grandparents too. And attachment theory doesn't account for that as well. But I digress. And so if we go back to the disorganized attachment style, the child then starts to feel disorganized. And because the child doesn't know what to expect from their primary caregiver. So if they see this primary caregiver as a safe haven, but they also sense fear because the primary caregiver is inflicting fear, or primary caregivers are making them feel afraid, they then don't know if their needs are going to be met, or if they are even, you know, safe to be able to voice their needs too. And another reason for the fear that psychologists suggest is a reason why people develop a disorganized attachment style is witnessing a traumatizing experience that involves the primary caregiver. So this could be physical abuse, verbal abuse, or even sexual abuse as well. And the end result of all of that is that the child essentially no longer trusts the caregiver, because, you know, why would you? If they are inflicting fear, if you see them, you know, abusing other people, you will learn not to trust them as well.
Yeah, these are all just perfectly rational responses to the environment they're in.
Yes, exactly. And I guess the difference with the other attachment styles is that not only the primary caregiver isn't meeting the child's needs, they are also a source of fear as well. And this is what makes the disorganized attachment style within the attachment model slightly different to the other two as well. Because if you have, say, a parent who is inconsistent, which is the assumption, you know, when we're talking about anxious or avoidant attachment style, somebody can be inconsistent, but they may not necessarily be causing fear, unless you're talking about the child developing a fear that their needs won't be met, which is the case in the anxious attachment style, which can then cause them to resort to protest behaviors later on down the line. But yeah, essentially, a person with a disorganized attachment style, psychologists would say, that their attachment style is essentially rooted in fear and their belief that they are not safe in their relationships as well. So some of the signs that, you know, psychologists say are indicative of a disorganized attachment style, again, it's almost like a hybrid approach of the anxious and the avoidant attachment styles as well. So symptoms such as poor emotional regulation, so they can have mood swings, temper tantrums as well, low self-esteem. They can be quite dichotomous in that they can either seek extreme closeness with somebody or extreme distance, and they don't really have almost like a middle ground. They fear abandonment, but they also fear intimacy, which sort of mirrors the traits of somebody who is avoidant as well. And they struggle to trust people because, again, if they've been either subjected to or witnessed or both abuse in their childhood, it's understandable why they would struggle to trust the people around them, because trusting people could mean getting hurt as well.
Yeah, this is like perfectly rational feelings. I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm sympathizing with this, things looking a little familiar, some of this behavior, but I think your earlier point in the last episode about how so much of this is situational attachment too, it's like if you just never experienced a safe environment in order to have a healthy attachment with someone, how would you even know how to do it, or why would you even expect it?
Yeah, exactly. Another thing that psychology likes to do is they like to set ages as to when people formulate their behavior or their character. Like there is a ongoing debate, for example, about, you know, when is our personality determined? There used to be the idea that by the time you're 30, your personality is set, but recent studies have shown that it isn't quite clear. And actually that our personalities are very different in different situations. For example, the way you present yourself at work will be very different to the way you present yourself when you're out with friends, as it probably should be. And so, you know, when we talk about attachment theory and we say, you know, it's set as an infant and then it stays with you your whole life, it doesn't take into account the fact that a lot of things can happen between being an infant and even being an adult as well. There are so many things that can happen that could potentially cause this that actually don't have anything to do with, you know, what happened to you in your childhood, if that makes sense. And so I think it's another huge flaw of the theory in that it focuses heavily on the infant years, which I think is a good period of time to study, especially when we're talking about child development and parenting. But I struggle to believe that the patterns are as rigid as they say, because so much happens.
Yeah, I think what's scary too is, like, I know to a certain extent that a lot of the behaviors that will affect you in adulthood are sometimes caused by the way your brain develops in childhood. So I wonder if they overemphasize and overstudy childhood because they feel like, okay, due to X amount of trauma happened to you during this time, your brain is now wired this way. And it's basically very difficult for it to unfuck itself, for lack of a better term, in adulthood. But I agree with you in the sense of, like, it seems weird to me that you couldn't heal your brain in adulthood, but you can definitely fuck your brain up in adulthood, right? So, like, you could become an anxious, avoidant attachment style because of a bad relationship you had in adulthood, right? So I would think that you could also recover. So I guess it's like the overemphasis on, like, the child development, maybe because of that idea or bias that basically whatever happens when you're a kid is permanent for some reason, which I don't know, may or may not be true, maybe partially true.
Yeah. And again, it's really difficult to determine the path of causation as well. Like, this is the reason why doing, essentially being able to study human behavior is actually really difficult. And if you were to do it properly, it would also probably be very, very unethical, because what, off the back of what Ro just said, if we truly wanted to understand the impact of, you know, let's say attachment theory and, you know, how it's formulated, essentially what we would need to do is we would need to remove all the extraneous variables that could possibly occur. So an extraneous variable, to describe a research term, is essentially a variable that you're not testing but could influence the result. So let's say you want to attest how children form attachment, for instance, with their primary caregiver, you would have to essentially make sure that the research subjects, in this case, the primary caregiver and the child are in an isolated environment where the child isn't also influenced by the behavior of the secondary caregiver, if that makes sense, because otherwise that could influence the result of what you're trying to test, which is essentially what is the impact of the child's attachment to the primary caregiver on their attachment style later on in life. Then you'd have to do a longitudinal study, which is essentially a study that happens over many years with the same like research subjects, which are very, very expensive. And they also tend to not be viable from a research standpoint because people die, people drop out, people lose contact with the researchers. And so that's just quite a long-winded way of agreeing with Rose's point in that actually trying to study like human behavior in its purest form is incredibly difficult. And for that reason, very, very few like longitudinal studies of people are actually approved within psychology because they're just really difficult. And if we truly wanted to test it in its purest form, it would also be an unethical study as well, because we'd essentially just have to isolate the child and the primary caregiver and see what happens, which just wouldn't, essentially no ethics board would approve such an experiment because it wouldn't be ethical to put research subjects through that as well. Okay. On to the final attachment style then. So this is the secure attachment overview. So as I said at the top of the episode, people who are, or the secure attachment style is seen as the gold standard of attachment. And it basically does what it says on the tin. Essentially, attachment theory posits that adults have a secure attachment style because when they were a child, they felt confident that their primary caregiver will meet their needs. And so in childhood, the child feels that they have a secure base from which they can explore the world, but they also know they can rely on this secure base if they need to. If you'd like to find out more information about this idea of this secure base, I will drop a link to a study called The Strange Situation by a psychologist called Mary Ainsworth that tests this theory out. Again, the study has limitations, but it's a great way to further understand what is meant by this concept of secure base as well.
I always wonder too, though, again, and this is a side note, but secure attachment, as we stated at the beginning of the episode, a lot of people look at it like it's this gold standard of attachment styles and that's what we should all strive to achieve. But truthfully, sometimes people can expect things like we talk about scrotes on this podcast all the time, and they are certainly very, very good at expecting people to provide for their needs because they are used to, like, women to a certain extent catering most often like their mom or their primary female caregivers. That's not necessarily a good thing, right? You know what I'm saying?
It's true. That's so true. And it's also like when men cheat as well, like in their mind, you know, part of the reason why a lot of men who cheat, they do so for such a long time is because, or people who cheat, but you know, I'm just going to say men, the purpose of this, I feel like it, but they have that secure base at home, which they see as their wife, that they know that they can rely on almost whilst they go out and fuck around behind her back, if you see what I mean as well. So yeah, I never thought of it that way, that it can actually be used in a maladaptive way, this whole secure attachment. Because, you know, something like cheating or something like expecting women to be at your beck and call, that's really, really ballsy. That's a ballsy thing to do, but it happens all the time.
Yeah, you really got to believe the universe is going to rise up to meet you when you make demands.
Yeah, and you really have to believe that there is a woman that will put up with that and that will do it. And I guess some men are somewhat validated in that there are a lot of women who will, you know, do all that and put up with it. So yeah, that's a really good point. And so I guess other attributes of that contribute to a child developing a secure attachment style is the caregivers give, they are able to strike the right balance between allowing the child to explore and giving them support as well. And they're also attuned to their child's needs and can meet them consistently. Another criticism I have of this is that I'm not trying to make excuses for like bad parenting, and I'm not talking about parents who are just basically shit parents, but I feel like the only way, or like the way the model positions a secure attachment style, is that the parent has to be perfect all the time. Like they have to be attuned to their child's needs, they have to be able to meet them all the time. And, you know, whilst I do believe parents should strive to meet their child's needs as and when, but it's not an easy job and parents aren't going to get it right all the time. Even parents who, you know, really want to do their best at parenting, they're not going to get it right all the time. And I feel like the attachment model, basically, if you want to raise your child with a secure attachment style, then you have to be a perfect parent. But if we accept that no parent is perfect, but there are still people who are secure walking around, doesn't the theory somewhat contradict itself in that manner? That's just me just throwing it out to the universe there. And most importantly, the child feels valued as a human being and their own individual and not seen as an extension of their parents. And I think, generally speaking, even though I'm not a parent, but I do think parents should strive to make their child feel that way, generally speaking, because children, you know, whilst you gave birth to them or, you know, whilst you're raising them, they are also individual beings of their own. And I do sometimes feel like it can seem like some people maybe don't recognize that a child is not necessarily an extension of themselves. They may not make the same decisions as them, and they are their own individual being as well. And so these are the supposed signs that somebody has a secure attachment style. Again, the theory suggests that people who are secure have a low tolerance for dysfunctionality in relationships. So I know in the book Attached, the authors make the case, or they include case studies where somebody who had a secure attachment style was dating and a person who was avoidant, and they quickly just ended the relationship because they're not there to play games. They're not here to chase people. They don't really engage in the entire, you know, I'm hot today, cold tomorrow sort of thing. They find it easy to open up and be intimate with people, especially if they are pursuing a relationship or seek to pursue a relationship or a friendship with that person. They are comfortable being alone and exploring the world. Because I do think that in today's society, especially as women, but more broadly, there is still this huge stigma about being single. And it's like being single, it doesn't have to be the same as being lonely as well. So people with a secure attachment style, they say that they are comfortable being single. And even in a relationship, they don't become enmeshed with their partners. Like, have you ever met those couples, Ro, where they just become a two-for-one deal when they get married? So they have the same friendship circles. If one person doesn't go out, the other person doesn't go out either. You know, if one person goes out, the other person, or if like one person stays at home, they both stay at home. And that can be quite common, at least from what I've seen in relationships, that sort of enmeshment. And they then have like exactly the same friends. And I don't know. I would find that suffocating personally.
Yeah, I mean, I know we've been criticized for being like avoidantly attached because of previous episodes we've done on this. We're like, I think me and you are on the same page where we just don't need as much like constant contact. But for people for whom that is like level enmeshment, like feels natural to them, I wouldn't say that they're insecurely attached, meaning like they have to do all these things together. That just seems to be like a natural comfort level with their partner. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I just always just think, even in a relationship, it's just good to have your own breathing space.
I agreed. No arguments for me over here. I mean, I'm trying to play devil's advocate for the people who I know are going to criticize us for this, because they're like, well, I spend every day with my boyfriend. Like, I'm not anxiously attached. It's just like, you know, a natural extension of our love for each other, et cetera. Or they're just naturally friends, or they just develop the same friend group. You know, it's also very common, like an introvert extrovert couple. So like sometimes the introvert person needs the extrovert person to cultivate like their social life. So I look at that as like symbiotic, right? So like the introvert person just kind of gets dragged along with the extrovert person's overall social engineering. I don't think it's like indicative of anything dysfunctional.
No, they're playing to different strengths.
Yeah, exactly. They have different strengths.
Yeah, definitely. So people are secure. They can communicate their needs effectively. Again, this may not necessarily be a good thing as well, something to watch out for, because communicating your needs effectively can also involve the person resorting to manipulation to get their needs met, because that's an effective tactic, right?
Exactly. There's just certain people, they come from enough privilege in whatever life they have, they're just very comfortable making demands on others. I wouldn't necessarily call them like narcissistic. If you're a narcissistic person, you can definitely come across like securely attached, and like it's making people who are less securely attached feel bad, or like they're not as good at articulating their needs. But it's like, well, they've never had an environment where that was even an option, right? So like even having the environment where it's an option to be able to like articulate what you need and what you want is a privilege that just not everybody has. And some people have a lot of it because they are coddled a lot.
Exactly. They tend to have a positive view of themselves and their childhood, which again, I would also like to question, because I think attachment styles, if they exist, they can be very fluid. So it's possible for somebody who may not have had a great childhood to go on to develop a secure attachment style and be secure in relationships as well. I don't necessarily think that somebody having a negative view of their childhood, especially if it was objectively terrible, it means that they're not securely attached or that they don't have these traits. They also tend to handle breakups and difficult life events well, and they have good mental and emotional resilience.
This just sounds like someone who had like a middle class upbringing and their parents were outwardly abusive. You know what I'm saying? Like anybody who's ever anxiously or insecurely attached people, they may have just taken on the stress of their economic environment, right? Like their parents are stressed because their parents couldn't afford anything. I don't know. I'm hating on securely attached people right now. Fuck you and your functional ass relationships. Sorry.
But that's a valid criticism of the study as a whole, because again, it was done on, you know, white American middle-class families.
Yeah, get a bigger cross-section of people, like different cultures and different economic environments, different countries.
But yeah, I mean, that's, again, that's just a general drawback of the whole theory, is that it's very much rooted in the Western way of raising children. And even midwives in the UK, they sometimes say, or at least when my sister was pregnant, they said to her that the Western model of raising children might not be the most effective way of raising children, and that other cultures, they might have a better idea of how to raise children.
Yeah, the Western model is all about individualism and like the nuclear family. And it's, in my opinion, a byproduct of capitalist interest. It's like it fosters competition between you and your community rather than cooperation between you and your community. And why? So they can sell you stuff. It's like keeping up with the Joneses, right? Like you want to feel better than your neighbor. You don't want to feel in tandem or in a community with your neighbor. No reasons for that.
Blame the filthy capitalists. But yeah, and they often also say that, and I'm not sure if this is like nice guy propaganda, so to speak, but they often say that being, you know, let's say an avoidant or an anxiously attached person or a disorganized attached person dates a secure person, they will find them boring in quotation marks because they tend to be, I guess, more emotionally stable. That's the argument. But I don't know, that sometimes feels like it could be weaponized by like the nice guys. Do you know what I mean? Like saying, well,
yeah, that sounds like nice guy propaganda.
You know, I'm a nice guy. You know, why does she find me boring? And actually, you could just not be exciting to them. Like that doesn't, do you know what I mean?
I sometimes find securely attached people more boring because they just haven't had the breadth of life experience and fucked up experiences that people with more interesting attachment styles have. Meaning like, it's not that they're boring, it's that they literally cannot relate to people who have had colorful experiences in life, right? So I feel like that's not really fair to be like, well, they're not boring, it's just that they're not likely to understand you, and vice versa. You're not likely to understand them.
And they could just actually be boring to you. Like there's this whole idea that secure partners are the reason why somebody might not want to date a secure person has got nothing to do with their attachment style. And maybe they're just not compatible as people, or maybe they don't have, you know, their goals and values don't align. Doesn't necessarily mean that they're boring, like, so to speak. And I feel like the term boring in this context, it means that the partner wants drama, but the secure person isn't giving it, if that makes sense. So the secure person is sort of let off the hook when actually people might find you boring for reasons that have got nothing to do with your attachment style. Yeah, that's a bit, could be twisted to be like, you know, nice guy propaganda. Okay, so there is a school of thought within psychology that is suggesting that there might be more attachment styles identified, but the four that we've discussed in this episode and the previous episode on attachment are the main ones. Now, the first thing I would say to any woman looking to date is don't fixate on attachment styles. Again, this is a useful piece of information to be aware of just for your own knowledge, but when you are out dating, it is a much, much better reference point is to focus on the man's actions and how you feel, because ultimately that is all that matters. Like, as we've said, people with a secure attachment style are also capable of treating you badly in relationships. It doesn't necessarily have a bearing on, you know, whether they're a good partner or whether that you are compatible as well. Because I also feel like the influences of patriarchy, for example, are not stated at all within the theory when we know that is huge. If we look at things like anxious attachment style, for example, patriarchy makes women or encourages women to behave in a way that is anxiously attached.
Yeah, it's kind of part of the whole deal. Yeah, it's basically, if you're taught from the time you're young to seek validation from men, when you encounter men who don't go along with that script, it's basically going to make you feel unstable, right? Because men are unstable.
Yes. And then you double down trying to prove your worth to men. And we see this all the time. You know, women compromising on their boundaries, you know, just to please men because they've internalized the message that, you know, if a man doesn't find them attractive or useful, you know, then they don't have any worth at all. And so attachment theory also, it doesn't acknowledge the dynamics and just the sheer differences in the way that men and women are raised, even by their own parents. Anybody who has, or any woman who has a male sibling can attest to the fact that, or at least I might be speaking for myself here, but I don't know of any woman with a male sibling who can say that they were raised the same way as their male sibling.
Yeah, I know. Side note, even if your parents attempt to, society doesn't. So it becomes very clear very quickly that your trajectory and your brother's trajectory are going to be very different in life.
Yes, exactly. Then we have, don't try to armchair diagnose people with a certain attachment type. This is a complete waste of your time. And as we've said, that it might not even be accurate as well. So the only thing you can really go off is their actual actions. Because again, as I've mentioned before, especially women who identify as anxiously attached, they become very attached to their own diagnosis. So they try and diagnose the men that they're with. Usually they're diagnosed as avoidance. And that can keep them in the trap of the relationship. Because as I said at the top of the episode, as opposed to looking at the behaviours the man is exhibiting and thinking, actually, he doesn't meet my needs, they start saying, oh, he's just an avoidant, I don't know what to do, like, help me manage his avoidant behaviour. When actually they should be saying, these behaviours are not making me feel safe in this relationship, I don't like this relationship, so I'm opting out as well.
Peace out, yeah.
And also, that's just unpaid emotional labour. Like, it's just like when women, you know, sit around trying to decipher a man's behavior. Like, one of the most poignant FDS posts that I read, one of the first ones that I read, was where the poster said, if you have to Google the man's behavior, you've basically already lost. Like, it's a lost cause.
Right. Honestly, facts. If you ever get to the point where you have to Google, like, what is going on with this person because they're not communicating with you, or it's just making you feel uncomfortable, it's probably already done. It's over.
It's a lost cause.
Yeah. Anything other than like a head injury or some kind of like illness symptoms, maybe, is the only thing I would Google about your man.
But even if it's a head injury or like illness symptoms, he can Google that himself.
What if his fingers are literally chopped off due to an unforeseen motorcycle accident?
Well, then I will just be part of the male statistics who leave their partners when they're sick.
What if he's blind and has no fingers? Then what? Then you gotta go. Trying to think of,
should I leave him? Should I leave?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to, we're never gonna tell you no. You can leave for whatever reason.
That's the only thing I'll be googling. Joking. Well, it depends.
Yeah, actually, don't even Google that. You know you don't want to be there. Just go. Staring across the aisle of your eyeballness, fingerless man.
If I leave this man now, will I be on the hook? Will I be on the hook for his medical bills? You need to get the legal advice straight. That's what you should be Googling.
There we go. That's why you Google it.
And my final point as well is directed more, because as I've said, even though I said you shouldn't armchair diagnose people, but I personally believe that society encourages women to behave in an anxiously attached way. So by chasing men who are unavailable. And if you've noticed this pattern in your relationships as well, it would be worth considering, you know, what it is that the outcome that you expect from chasing men who are emotionally unavailable, or men who don't treat you as you deserve to be treated as well. You don't necessarily have to do this in therapy. Like, I definitely feel therapy is an overstated solution to a lot of emotional problems. It just takes some self-awareness and actually being alone and getting to a point where you can compare a man's contribution to your life as a solo woman. As I've said before, a mistake that a lot of women tend to make in relationships is that they will compare their current relationship to a previous relationship. And if we accept that the bar for men is literally in hell, you're starting from a very, very low bar to begin with. So this is what I would say, is that, you know, have some introspection as well. But as I've also said in the previous episode too, like, if you, you know, feel anxious or unsafe in a relationship or in response to objectively bad treatment, that doesn't mean that you have a disordered attachment style. That is a valid response to not getting your needs met, you know, by somebody who is supposed to be meeting your emotional needs, like a partner in a relationship should be able to do.
And this has been my gripe with pretty much all of pop psychology, is like, I feel like women will read all this stuff and then give them, like, diagnose themselves. And every time they hear some new type of psychology jargon, they'll see how it fits in their life. And meanwhile, men are doing none of this shit, right? They're just kind of getting to exist to a certain extent. And I'm not saying, like, I don't mean men as in every single man that's ever existed, but like men as a group, right? When you look at like psychology books, when you look at relationship books, overwhelmingly they're purchased by women. So a lot of times when I hear all of this stuff about, like, if you start to Google, like, am I anxiously attached, and you've never felt that before, it could just be the douchebag you're with. Like, instead of adopting it as an unfixable personality trait that's inherent to you, putting yourself in a place or away from this person such that, like, you can be in a healthy relationship that's not being triggered to be anxious because, yeah, the guy you're with is a douchebag, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah, so I think in terms of where attachment theory sits in the FDS repository, I would say it's good for information only, but I wouldn't pay much attention to it. I think human behavior is way more nuanced than the theory sets out. And ultimately, as we say with FDS, the way to make your dating life easy and stress-free is to look at the empirical evidence in the form of the man's behavior, because that is actually objective. The way he's behaving is an objective measure of his behavior, not some, you know, random attachment theory from the 1970s that may or may not be applicable to it.
Got it.
And that's on that.
And that's on that. Check us out on the website, thefemaledatingstrategy.com. If you are still on the dumpster fire that is Twitter/X, I'm not really on there much anymore, but...
Oh my God, I don't blame me.
We're at fem.strat. Check us out on Patreon, patreon.com/thefemaledatingstrategy, and Instagram @_thefemaledatingstrategy. Thanks for listening, queens.
And to all you scrotes out there, we don't care what your attachment style is. Just sort yourselves out.
Honestly, yeah, figure it out.
And die mad.
Die mad. See y'all next week.